Fresh Perspective features young professionals in the scrap and recycling industry, offering insights from the next generation of industry leaders. Guests share their stories of what led them to the scrap industry and new ideas on industry trends. Tune in to hear stories from scrap processors, traders, operators, and others who are starting to lead in this space. Fresh Perspective is beginning an ongoing dialogue with the future executives of the industry.
Hi, my name is Megan Smalley, and I'm with Recycling Today magazine. Welcome to the Fresh Perspective podcast. I'm here today with Neil Neuberger, who is a metal trader at Intrametco. Neil began his career working in the petroleum industry in Wyoming, but he transitioned to work in the scrap industry about 5 years ago for the company. The company serves as a trader of ferrous and non-ferrous metals, as well as offering logistics, sourcing, and risk mitigation services. So thanks for coming in the show today, Neil. How are things going?
Thanks for having me. They're going really good. Yeah, it's been an interesting week, and I'm kind of glad to be here and glad to talk to you.
Prior to joining the scrap industry, your career began in the petroleum industry in Wyoming. So, Neil, tell me a little bit about your time in the petroleum industry, and then from there, how did you end up in scrap?
Sure. And that is a sort of interesting story. So Wyoming, a lot of people don't know, is an energy state. There is natural gas, oil. It was one of the largest producers of coal for a while before that industry kind of was forced to shut down. They have wind energy. It's one of the few places that have uranium mining as well. So with that being said, the university is pretty energy centric. I got my undergrad in chemical engineering, and by the time I was graduating, it was at the beginning of an oil boom. So pretty much anybody with an energy degree could make a lot more money in the petroleum field. So instead of getting a chemical engineering job, I moved into petroleum like all my friends did. I picked up with a company called Baker Hughes, and I actually moved down to West Texas. I worked on their electrical submersible pumping line, which is essentially just a piece of equipment that pumps oil out of the ground. Working in Texas, I had the opportunity to take an international assignment where I lived in Ciudad del Carmen, Mexico, which is the Gulf of Mexico side of Mexico, probably about 8 hours from Cancun. Worked offshore, onshore, just doing kind of the same thing. And then I ended up back in Texas. The thing about oil is there's usually not oil in the prettiest, funnest places to live in the world. So I was kind of burnt out of really just, you know, living in oil places. And I had the opportunity from one of my professors to essentially go back to school. And they said I could qualify for this grant to get an MBA if I concurrently got a master's in petroleum engineering. And so I was at a point in my career where I didn't really want to keep doing engineering, but I figured, sure, I'll get a master's if I can get the MBA, which is what I wanted. While in grad school, one of our professors connected me with a gentleman at CME Group who I think he's the chief risk officer for CME Group. He was a Wyoming alumni. And I got an internship at CME Group in Chicago. So I moved out there and I was working at CME Group when I met a girl on Bumble, and we started dating for most of the summer. And then after I graduated, I moved back and actually got a job at the exchange. And what's really interesting is I was on vacation with my girlfriend in Florida. Her neighbor growing up was the owner of Intrametco. And so we were at his condo in Florida playing a board game. I think it was Codenames. We're playing a board game. We're talking about each other's, you know, qualifications or whatever. I told him my backstory. And I'm on this guy's team. His name's John Town. And we're doing pretty well. And at one point in the game, towards the end of the night, he said, "Neil, you know, we're looking for a trader. He goes, you've got the right mind. You've got the trader mind based on my board game abilities." So I said, "Oh, okay." I thought that was a joke. So I sort of blew it off and went back to work. And a few months later, the CFO of Intrametco called me and said, "Neil, are you going to ever take that interview you said you were going to do?" And I said, "Oh, that was genuine. Okay, sure." So I learned more about the company, and it actually was a pretty good fit for my abilities in terms of having a background in commodities, having experience at the exchange. I knew nothing about scrap or the industry, but it actually was a pretty good fit. So I came down, I interviewed with Intrametco, and the rest is history. And from my time in the industry, not being a person who was born into it, I feel like everybody I meet is either a legacy person who was born into it and they have a 100-year heritage, or they were married into it, or they have some unique story of how they got in. But those are the only people I meet, is married in, born in, or just randomly trip and fell into the industry. But I've not met a lot of people who get into the industry and then end up leaving. It seems like it's blood in, blood out. Once you're in, and people end up loving it and they stay in forever is what it seems like.
Definitely. That's quite the path into the industry. So thanks for sharing that. Who would have thought that a game night would lead to the industry? Now, when you took that job at Informatico, did you think, this is just a short stint, or, you know, did you consider this might be the path I take?
When I took the job, it was very seriously considered. I knew that it was a small company. I knew that they did not hire very frequently. I would say the average tenure of the traders are probably over 15 years here. You have three of the traders have been here for 30, one person for 15. They don't hire very often. And having a connection to my now wife, but at the time, my girlfriend, I knew that it was not something, it would cause a serious strain if I didn't seriously consider this job, not as a stepping stone, but just as a career. So I looked into it a lot, and no, it was going to be kind of a like, hey, let's sign, not your life away, but let's sign up for a serious commitment. I told myself that regardless of how much I liked or disliked it going in, I would give it 5 solid years before I made any decisions, because not knowing an industry, it will probably take you 2 to 3 years to even catch up to speed. I mean, my background's in chemical engineering. It probably took me 2 years in petroleum before I even knew what was going on. So I didn't think it'd be fair to join metals and hate it a year in and then just leave. And I started my career in not the best market. There was, I started at the tail end of a down market. Then there was an entire year of trade wars, which was very rough on the industry. And then there was, it kind of built back up, and there was COVID and everything else. So it was definitely a rocky path to start a new career in metals.
Yeah, I think you mentioned you joined Informatico as a trader in 2018. What were those first couple of years like for you in the scrap industry, and did you have misconceptions about it or things you knew going in, or kind of went in blind?
Yeah, I would say that I had only misconceptions about it. I had no idea that this industry existed. I had no idea that it was so robust, so efficient. I was under the impression that scrap was taking, pop cans and giving it to a guy at, I used to call it junkyards, and I always got my wrist slapped in the office. You can't say that. I remember when I was brand new, I would say, yeah, what about the junkyards? And they're just like, no, Neil, no, they're scrap yards. It's not junk. It has value as scrap. First off, my first couple of years were very, very difficult. If you're going to be a trader or a broker, in theory, you know what you're doing. You don't want to sell or buy from somebody who has no idea what's going on. So you have to learn the industry from the ground up and then learn it to a proficiency where people will trust your opinion or trust that you know what you're doing. And then you need to essentially, make a market for a lot of people. Earlier, I mentioned that being kind of a small company, there's a lot of freedom to do whatever you want. That freedom is excellent currently because I know the industry and it's great, but that is a very tough learning environment, not having structure. Hey, Neil, you are here. Learn the industry. Go make some money. Do whatever you want. I mean, it was a little more than that, but it was very, very trying for a while. But it's almost like you have to go through the trials to break through, and then you've earned it. You become a real trader. So it was very tough, but some of the other misconceptions, when I was coming in, I just assumed that it was, a non-intelligent industry, but I could not have been wrong. There's so much just efficiency and knowledge and values extracted from everything. I mean, some of these producers or these dealers, they can just get value out of anything. It's amazing. To me, go out and say, well, that's a pile of dirt, and it's not. There could be 10% copper fines in this pile of dirt, and someone somewhere in the world is going to pay for it. it's incredibly entrepreneurial is one of the things I've noticed. There's no one way to kind of invent the wheel in the scrap world. And it's just very interesting. I mean, you have guys who have started from nothing. You hear that story all the time, and they've done it in a different way. And for an industry that's so old, it's interesting that it's always just being reinvented. One of the misconceptions was that it was easy. To me, it sounds easy. You buy, and then you buy low and you sell high. Like, that doesn't sound very hard, but it's difficult. There's financing, and there's shipping, and there's freight. There's all these problems that happen.
So today, what are some unique projects that you're working on at Intermetco that you could speak to? And it sounds like Intermetco is pretty small company and has stayed that way. Talk a little bit about working in a small company, and you said a couple times you've got a lot of freedom there.
Right. So yeah, so it is kind of interesting. Like I said, I would classify this as a small, medium company in terms of trading. You have your giant trading firms, and then you have what I would call a one-man chop shop, and we're somewhere in the middle. But by not having a whole bunch of overhead, fixed costs, we're pretty nimble. We can do a lot of different things. And even being here for the 5 years I've been, you can almost see the ebb and flow of where deals are going. So for example, last year, there was tons and tons of export. I mean, our export volumes were way higher than they historically ever been. And that was good. It was great. This year, you know, we're still exporting. It's still a core business, but I'm seeing a lot more RSI moving, things like that. There's been almost a shift to domestic. And that really just follows the market. That's how I would describe it. Is you some years the export market's very hot, some years the domestic market's hot. You might see an opportunity to toll or convert. I mean, for example, right now, if you're trying to convert metal or scrap into RSI, there's not capacity anywhere or very little. In some years, that's the case. And if you're already converting, it's great. If you're not, it's hard to get your foot in the door. In other years, it's not like that. So I would say right now I'm just kind of doing what I've always done, but it's just changed. The volumes have changed. The projects have changed a little bit. We've not. It's interesting that you mentioned about the growth. The company in terms of headcount has not drastically grown on purpose, I would say, but our volumes have steadily increased probably for the last, 10, 15 years. And I don't know if we're getting more efficient or people are working harder. I would say in the last few years, we established a kind of a trading branch out of Shanghai, which goes hand in hand with doing more export business. And I think in the future, I'm not sure, I can't really speak to what we're going to do, but I know we have a couple of kind of behind closed doors projects in the pipeline that should come to fruition by the end of this year. So there's some changes coming, but I'd probably get in trouble if I spoke to them just yet.
Now, you mentioned, Neil, you guys do some export and you have somebody in Shanghai at Intermetco, but also do trading domestically. How much domestic trading do you guys do versus export? Does it vary based on the year, the season, the commodity?
Yeah, that's a good, it definitely varies by season and commodity. I would say the company historically has always done more domestic, and that probably holds true today. I would, without looking at the numbers, more than 50% by volume is going to be domestic aluminum. We also do trade ferrous. We trade copper. We trade all of that. In terms of export, like I mentioned, it's more, the bulk of it is going to be shred grades, your Zorba, Zurich, Twitch, heavies. But we also will trade normal grades, your normal packages that would go to a dealer. In terms of where we export, Asia is probably the bulk, but Italy as well. It just depends on the market, like everything else. I know for all of last year, the Midwest premium was high, which essentially made Italy, Europe very difficult to trade to, just because a lot of the guys are pricing off of just the LME portion of the Midwest price. And last year we saw historically high premiums. I want to say it was up to 40 cents at some point. It's backed off a lot since then. But yeah, I mean, we have a lot of some legacy deals that we do where it'll be X volume a month. We take positions as well and backfill them. We have constant volume going to some of the mills, some of the die casters, and then we'll just backfill it with spot deals as well. So like everything else, it ebbs and flows. But if you were to look at the company, you could say, generally speaking, the largest volume by revenue would be aluminum. Volume by volume would probably be ferrous. So that's just because it moves so much more. I don't think that's an apple to apple comparison. And then it would be export shred grades is high, and then your red metals after that.
And I know export can be fairly challenging. There's like a lot of headwinds there. You know, a couple of years ago you had COVID. Then since then, it seems like there's constant issues. So I guess, what are some of the challenges related to export and how have you been navigating those?
I would say anybody who exports probably had a fun time last year. So last year, logistically, was just a nightmare. Everybody says the same thing. And what's interesting is by the time that the government caught wind of how bad it was probably already a year of just a mess at all the ports. And so what happened is, and I don't know if this is a subset of COVID or just circumstance, the U.S. was paying so much money for containers to come. I was hearing $20,000 for containers to move to the U.S. But when you're selling scrap on the way back, it could be $1,200 or, you know, $2,000. So what was happening is you were getting these large steam lines who were essentially just sending empty containers back because the amount of time it would take to wait and fill it with scrap was not worth them just shipping empties back and then reshipping them here for the $20,000. And so it created just this massive issue on trying to get containers that were scrap worthy, because usually they have to be 10 years old or something of that sort, and then getting the equipment to move it. It was a disaster trying to move. There was three or four ramps in the US that were just a disaster to move equipment out of. And then for some reason, which to this day, nobody can tell me, there was a chassis shortage. And I do not know, perhaps somebody listening can contact me and explain why there's a chassis shortage, because they don't leave the US. They are here, the chassis exist. But for the entire year, there was just a chassis shortage. So by the time you got a container and a booking, you couldn't get a chassis. And it was just this never ending cycle. I would get a booking for 2 weeks from now, 2 weeks from now, the trucker doesn't have a chassis. Then it takes another 2 weeks to get a book. It would just take forever to move anything. And everybody was dealing with the same issues. So the industry was pretty understanding of that. Contracts were held a lot longer than they normally would on both the buyer and seller side. I would say that was a big issue. And then the other one was the market was running up like crazy last year. I mean, there was historically quick moves. And whenever that happens, when prices are changing by 5-10 cents a day in either direction, and you couple that with not being able to move material, then you really figure out who's a trustworthy shipper and consumer. And that's how people lose a ton of money. And I wasn't here for 2008, but I was told that was the exact same thing. You have these contracts that are way over the market. Market falls rapidly. All the material's on the water and all the deals are canceled. And that's how a lot of companies go bankrupt. I've noticed that logistics have gotten quite a bit better. I think that's probably because the total activity is slowing down for really everybody. But really, really logistics was the hardest part of export. I think anybody who had access to their own equipment or was a volume shipper and had negotiated with the lines, they were at such a large advantage last year. They probably were probably printing cash, I would say.
I also am curious, aside from recession, inflation, and transportation challenges that we've already discussed, are there any other challenges that you see the scrap industry facing this year? And how is Intermetco affected by these challenges?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say there are a handful of them. First one would be with just the cost of money going up, it changes the dynamic of a lot of people's business. Scrap's generally a cash business, everybody knows. Whether you've got a really great company or, you know, your cash flow is not as perfect, when somebody comes in and gives you metal, they usually expect to be paid. So with cost of money going up, it makes some deals not make sense. And some deals do make sense. So from our side, it's actually that's generally a good thing. So as a trading company, generally, you know, your credit's good and your money is pretty solvent, but it does make it difficult because you can't do as much business as you'd like to do in certain areas because it's cost prohibitive. So something that you, let's say, work on a tiny margin on in the past would no longer be viable just because the cost of money is too high and it makes business decisions a little bit different. Another challenge I sort of just touched on was the labor force. I'm seeing people have to actually slow down their production. I see this on the shredder side because they can't get enough people to work. And it's interesting because a lot of companies, like, so let's talk about shredders. A lot of them don't have the feedstock because their scrap flows are too slow, but other ones, they have plenty of stuff, but they don't have anybody to work. And I don't know why that's the case, but I see it in the Midwest more than other places. Everybody I talk to is still having issues with labor. And I don't know why. I thought a lot of that would have cleared up after COVID. The people who are doing these jobs generally aren't the older workforce. So I don't actually know why it's the case, but I've not talked to just about anybody who has done that. And so from our perspective as a company, it actually affects us because if we have a deal with a yard and they physically can't produce enough material because they don't have labor, it strains it and it gets to a point where the consumer is going to potentially start canceling the orders because you're slow shipping, which creates an issue for everybody, especially if the material's hedged. Because if you're trading copper, aluminum, that's hedged. If somebody cancels the order, somebody has to pay for it. And that's sort of an issue. I think we sort of touched on market uncertainty and recession. That's on everybody's mind. I would say scrap and metal in general, it's a commodity. Commodities are generally cyclic industries. In oil and energy, it's a boom and bust industry. I don't know if I would classify metals as boom bust, but it definitely is cyclic. You'll see a whole year of uptrend. You'll see a whole year of downtrend. And I think things like, you know, a recession, war, things of that sort are really disruptive because you can't plan for it. And it greatly affects, you know, your trajectory for the whole year.
Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about hiring. And, you know, you were not born into the industry, but a lot of people were born into it. And I'm sure that might happen less and less as time goes on. So, you know, what can the scrap industry be doing to get more people into the industry, those who aren't necessarily born into it? You know, folks who can be traders. And also, like you were saying, there's an issue of finding shredder operators. How can you find the right people for these jobs?
That is a great question. And honestly, I feel like if I knew the answer to that, I could probably quit my job and go consult. But it is very interesting because if it's an industry. So for example, if I'm back in the oil industry, when I get out of college or during college, I get an internship. And the knowledge I gain there will probably be applicable to any company I go work for. But it's not really like that in the scrap world. You can't just come work for somebody, a trading firm, for 3 months and have skills or experience that are going to translate to the job you eventually get after college if you're in that field. So I don't really know, because one side of me thinks you could make more awareness and you could do more outreach. But another side of me feels like the scrap industry kind of enjoys being behind the scenes. They don't like a lot of attention in a lot of ways, because even though it's an inherently green or recyclable industry, it gets a lot of bad rep for no reason. That's the one of the things that always baffled me. It's an inherently green, good environmental industry, but the amount of backlash is just wild. I don't know why. So we always contemplate that when we talk about hiring a new trader, a next trader, when we go back and forth, what is better, to have an experienced person or to have somebody like me where you're going to have essentially a financial burden for a few years training them from the ground up? And how do you do that and get the person to actually stick? You know, for me, I had some intrinsic motivation to stick with it based on, you know, my wife and her family and the company being small, but it'd be very hard to just grab somebody off the street and say, hey, we need you to, you know, develop 5 years, give us 5 years, and the first few are going to be miserable. Like, it's hard to do. We always say that in order to succeed in this industry, you really just need a good work ethic. I think hiring collegiate athletes or ex-military or somebody who has some grit. I think that those people would be great in this industry, but yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Right. And then you get into the issue of, well, how do I find this person? That's probably
right. Because nobody's going online. No one's going to ZipRecruiter saying, I want to, you know, be the shredder operator, like find me one of these jobs anywhere in the world. I want to be the operator. It's just, it's very niche, and it's, you know, it's kind of hard to find.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Neil's a final question here. I wanted to go all the way back your time in the petroleum industry. What were some lessons that you learned while working in petroleum that have translated to your time in the scrap industry? And, you know, what could other people learn from that?
You know, I would say the first one is something I sort of touched on. And that is, so the petroleum industry, the energy industry, that's a straight boom and bust industry. It is, times are good, times are bad. Everybody gets hired like crazy. It's a hiring fest. You name your own price. But the problem is when things turn, everybody gets laid off. Now in the scrap world, it doesn't seem like that. There are hiring frenzies, but I don't think everybody gets laid off on a down cycle. But since it is commodities, I think just keeping that in mind is if you're going to run a business, a successful business in the scrap world, you need to understand that it's not always going to be good times. It will be bad times. And you just have to, you know, not be a pig when times are good and kind of just buckle down when they're bad. A lot of the producers who we work with, the ones who classify their operations as producers, not traders, I think do the best. I talk to some of these yards and they say, you know, I'm a producer, metal in, metal out, turn it. I'm not worried about, you know, getting the highest price, bidding every deal. We're a producer. And those are the guys who do really well, I think, because they're not worried about the market and they can handle any market. It's the little yards who saved up one load of barite copper and they're playing the market, who end up losing, you know, a dollar a pound on it. That's how you can get into trouble. So I would say lesson one would just be commodities are commodities and they're hard to forecast. They're uncontrollable and they're cyclical. The second thing that I would say is very applicable is, so the scrap industry is very close knit, the metals industry in general. The petroleum industry is much larger, but it's similar. And then what I mean is, there's a lot of jumping from competition to other companies, especially during an upcycle in petroleum. So somebody who could have been your competition could be your boss, could be your subordinate, and vice versa. You know, somebody who works under me could get a better job and they could now be my customer. So it really helps to not burn bridges and to not, you know, not have too much of an ego. I think that lesson applies to the metals world really, really effectively. It seems like in this world, you know, kind of like I said, once you're in, but I've had met multiple people who I used to just, you know, beg and try as hard as I can to buy metal from. And then eventually they turn into a buyer somewhere else. And then they're asking me for metal and the dynamic totally shifts. I've seen a lot, not a lot, but I've seen a few, let's say a mill buyers, you know, you're a mill buyer, you're everyone's best. Everyone has to be nice to you. You have all the power. You see some of these guys and they, you know, they turn into a trader, they find a different position and they don't realize why it's so much harder. And it's because, well, you can't be rude to people. You can't be mean to people when you have all the power and expect them to still be your friend when you have no intrinsic power over people. So I would say, you know, everybody from a scale operator to a CEO, you need to treat people well and you need to treat people consistently. Because things change and they change on a dime. It could be one new hire and you could be blacklisted from an entire mill just because you were rude to a guy when he used to work under you. And I think that probably applies to most industries, but you know, in petroleum and energy and in scrap for sure. I think that's the big lesson is, you know, treat people fair and treat people consistently.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. It was great having you on today, Neil.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.